when you're dealing with a phenomenon that's rising, you have to deal with that phenomenon early, because once it's out of the box, it's almost unstoppable.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. I was quite interested to talk to Mark Penn. Mark is a former pollster and Democratic political strategist who spent years at the center of American politics, including 13 years as close advisor to Bill and Hillary Clinton. He also worked on numerous international election campaigns. Penn helped Bill Clinton after the 1994 midterm losses in his re-election in 1996, and helped Hillary win her New York Senate races in 2000 and 2006. And he was the chief strategist for her 2008 presidential campaign primary loss to Barack Obama. Mark Penn's work led to another career as well. His polling firm, which worked primarily for corporate clients like AT&T and Microsoft, he sold in 2001 to WPP, a giant holding company. Penn also ran Burst & Marsteller, another WPP firm, which was a global public relations and communications enterprise. Penn served for a number of years after that as VP and head of advertising for Microsoft. After Microsoft, Penn started his own holding company called the Stagwell Group, with a more digital marketing emphasis than he'd had before at WPP. His main funder was Steve Ballmer, the former president of Microsoft. Penn has so far aggregated 20 companies and grown Stagwell to 2,000 employees. And he has recently released the second edition of his book, Microtrends. Penn keeps his hand in politics by co-teaching a class at Harvard on government and writing political columns for The Hill. Penn calls himself a moderate in American politics, uncomfortable with the Democratic Party's move to the left. His recent columns about what he feels are overreach by the Mueller investigation run highly counter to current Democratic orthodoxy. And Penn's last race with Clinton and his current stances make him a controversial figure for Democrats and progressives. With all that to talk about, we had a very interesting conversation. I hope you will take a listen. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with a former Democratic strategist and CEO of the Stagwell Group, Mark Penn.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from TimePlots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. TimePlots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Hi, Mark. Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. Mark Penn, born in the Bronx. My father was in the kosher poultry industry, started out in the union and then got his own plant. My mother put herself through college, teacher's college, and when he passed away, went back to teaching. I started in the Bronx, worked my way up, got a good education. She believed in that. And almost coming out of college, started to do polling for candidates.
When you were in college, did you study politics? Did you study statistics?
I had actually done my first poll at age 13 when I was in...
Was it a scientific poll?
I copied the poll that CBS had used on its documentary about race relations. So I said, oh, this is interesting. I'll conduct the same poll of my teachers at the Horace Mann School in the Bronx, and then compare them to the rest of the nation. And they were actually, unsurprisingly, somewhat more liberal than the rest of the country and in tune with kind of race in a good way. So it was a pretty favorable report for the teachers. And many years ago, one of the teachers sent it to me.
Did you conduct that poll on paper?
Yeah, mimeograph.
Yeah.
At the time, or rexograph, as they used to call it, and tabulated the results. And I was just fascinated, really, since then. When I was editor of the school paper, I almost got thrown out of school for a poll because I...
This is high school?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I polled everyone on sex, drugs, and rock and roll and published it. And they said, you did what?
We don't want that information out there. You came out of college and you went into polling. How did you get going as a business?
Well, I was going to be a lawyer. I was always going to be a lawyer, especially when my father passed away and my mother found herself more or less told not to hire a lawyer, kind of adrift in many ways. But I enjoyed this as kind of a hobby. And I met a partner, Doug Schoen. We both were at Harvard. And he had a summer job with a media consultant, David Garth, and said, hey, I know you know how to do polls, because by then everybody knew I knew how to do polls. Maybe we should do a poll together. There's this guy, Ed Koch, who's going to run for mayor. So we got together, and that was pretty much our first poll.
How old were the two of you at the time?
We were called by one of the competitors of Peter Hart, actually, then, as the kid pollsters. So we must have been 20 years old, 21, something like that.
Pollsters like to say, I think, that there's sort of an art and a science to it. How were you on the art side at that point? How were you able to interact with someone running for mayor when you're a young man?
Well, there's an art and science of it in a lot of different ways. I mean, it's actually what made the whole thing so fascinating, because first, you really have to devise questions that are meaningful, that are not just fair, but really cover all the different sides of an issue and bring out a hypothesis or a theory. Now that poll was a remarkable poll. I unfortunately can no longer find it, because it basically posited the idea that running as a more independent mayor, even though Koch had been the most liberal member of Congress, right, given the New York City financial condition, what was the way to run. And so there's the poll, there's the questions, there's getting it accurate and right, and then there's explaining it. And these were our first meetings with Koch and David Garth and Bess Meyerson at the time. And it was an incredible experience. And of course, nobody expected Koch was going to win. So we had no support. There was like three people in the campaign. And then when he won the primary, everybody said, I was with you from the beginning, Ed. I've never seen anything like it.
To what extent do you think did his following, what you were finding out from the polling, play into that contest and how it went?
I think that poll was pretty important in outlining kind of the strategy that he evolved to really kind of stand up at that time to the demands of the municipal unions and to restore fiscal responsibility to New York. The city was almost bankrupt. Things were out of control. The city was really on the precipice in a way that I don't think people could even remotely understand today, because New York City is so big, so established, so stable, but that's not what it was like at all.
Right. It was kind of a scary time. So how did you turn that into some momentum for a business?
Well, Koch won. At that time, David Garth was the media consultant who said, wow, well, I won with Koch. It was my biggest victory. Then the Venezuelans actually read about it in Newsweek and said, well, you know, we're having a presidential election. How about coming down? Garth had first called Peter Hart, but Peter Hart said he doesn't travel. And so I got my passport and went down and polled in Venezuela.
How was that different than polling in New York City?
Well, it was polling from the ground up. They had no polling whatsoever. And so we created a whole field force. We did it door to door. I worked with some people at the university who then later established their own company growing out of the campaign. And it was bringing polling and information really to people in societies that at that time didn't have any reliable way. But the mayor thing led to the governor. And while I went to law school, we were polling all the time. So I had kind of had two jobs, law school and polling for all the local political figures.
Did that law degree play into your career much along the way?
Well, I never actually finished because I made the transition over to polling, and the demands of polling just kind of kept mushrooming. At that time, there were almost no polls, and we developed things on our own. You know, I built a PC and a kit because we didn't have a PC so that we could have overnight polling. Doug, I think, was really well known in West Side politics. And so both of us who kind of went down this law track said, you know, we could have a much bigger contribution to society just sticking with this polling.
And that firm continued for a long time and worked at every echelon, right?
Well, I used to say that we had the longest continuously operating political consultant partnership in history, because the political consultants had a habit of like being together for a cycle, fighting over the war chest, and then never speaking to each other again.
It does seem like pollsters change partners pretty often.
All the time. And that enabled us over the long term. We decided to build a business, to broaden it out, to give the people who are working for us not just like jobs for the election season, but to have a cycle. And one day I said, look, Doug, if you lose one more governor's race, we're out of biz. So let's go to AT&T and Texaco and others and kind of say, hey, we know how to do polls. Maybe you could use it. And it turned out to be a good strategy.
Over time, what sort of percentage of your business was more corporate and what was more political? How did that sort out?
Well, it's interesting because I personally went off in the 80s to do mostly foreign political. I did Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, Philippines, Thailand. Every developing democracy was, to me, really a fascinating thing. So I spent a lot of time on the plains while Doug was here at home doing, I think, the core democratic polling and really early leader, a lot of the leaders now who retired. And the Frank Lautenberg race was a big race that Doug and I did. Over time, as we introduced commercial, it's interesting. The young employees, once they would get into commercial, they would never want to go back to politics.
What was more exciting about commercial for them?
Less exciting.
Or less. They liked that because it was less exciting.
It was more regular. It was funny. All these people would be working on AT&T and Texaco and AOL, and eventually Microsoft became our biggest client. So I worked with them in the antitrust case, and they said, well, we like your method so much. How about just working on our products that way? But it was very interesting that the very bright kids we hired, given the choice between these super demanding political races and commercial, mostly chose the commercial. And so that became sort of 80-90% of the firm. Then Doug and I would have, I think, a pick of races. And obviously what happened was when I came back from the international races, we got drawn into President Clinton in the late 90s. And that, of course, changed, I think, the course of the firm and kind of what we did.
When did you become Bill Clinton's pollster?
Well, it was a complicated series of events. As I always say, it was the congressional elections of 1994 that got me my job. The other consultants had predicted that Clinton would do pretty well in the congressional elections. He got wiped out. He and Hillary, I think, rightly panicked that there's no way he'd win re-election. So he called back Dick Morris, who had consulted with him in Arkansas. Dick Morris knew Doug from kind of Upper West Side politics. And then maybe 2 months into it, I got to do a presentation to the president on his image and his more or less his brand image and standing, and he liked it. So then I became a member of what used to be the Wednesday night group, where we met secretly in the White House. I imagine today what would happen if you found out that there was a group in the White House that met secretly with the president, the chief of staff, and the vice president, and made decisions like whether to go after tobacco or not. And then in many ways, for maybe 4 or 5 months, we were a government within the government, helping direct the president so that he could refine his presidency. He felt a prisoner in his own staff and in his own White House. And this was a way of bringing him back to what he felt his administration should be about. And then everything came out, and then we became the chief campaign consultants. Through that, I developed the concepts of soccer moms and values and the polling on the government shutdown, much of which surprisingly remains relevant today as we go into rounds of new shutdowns. But polling through that and helping to advise, you know, the team and the president became my, you know, 100% occupation for years.
Can you explain or give an example of something that you were learning by polling people that you brought to the president that helped make a policy decision in concert with him?
There were a lot of examples. One of the biggest was probably Social Security first, part of what happened. And this kind of fast forwards past the campaign and And after the campaign, he said, you know what, I like these strategy meetings so much, Mark. And Dick had blown himself up. He said, well, Mark, why don't you just keep doing them? And we'll meet every Wednesday with the top staff of the White House. But I think that as the budget deficit was disappearing and surplus actually coming up, the question was, what was going to happen? Democrats didn't want to put in a tax cut. Republicans would want to take the money out. And the Social Security first just was a concept pulled off the charts and was an amazing way to kind of create a lockbox and kind of safeguard, at least until the Republicans came in, the growing surplus. So that's on a big level. There are hundreds of smaller, I think, decisions that the polling had input in. Polling didn't make decisions. It's not my belief the president made decisions on the basis of polling. Polling helps the president and the team meet their objectives by being able to present things in the right way, and also sometimes finding creative policy solutions. As I always say, try a gasoline tax in America, and everybody says no. Come forward with mileage standards that in effect accomplish the same thing, and everybody says yes. So there are a lot of different policies like that.
So how did that feel, kid from New York, to be commonly in the White House talking to the President of the United States? What was that feeling like?
Well, it's more unbelievable in retrospect. At the time, I was like too busy to breathe because between the campaign models, I wrote most of the ads in the end, and I went through virtually every word at every speech. In retrospect, nobody knew who I was. I was very under the radar screen, and so I would be in the White House virtually every day. I would be at all the press briefings, and then I'd meet with all the policy people like Elena Kagan weekly to scout for ideas. So it was an incredible position because I really did it for 6 years, and I look back at what an amazing opportunity I had to have a positive influence. And every time I thought, I guess they're going to get rid of this. I mean, they're not going to be that interested anymore. Something like impeachment would break out, and we go back on campaign footing, and we'd be polling every day, and we'd be trying to save the presidency from what we saw as a coup.
What was Bill Clinton like to work with?
When I first met the president, I only had these sort of caricature views of $200 haircuts and God knows what's going on there in the White House. And it just took me 5 minutes to see, hey, this is a serious policy-oriented operation, given real thought to the things that they do in a serious way. I always consider my kind of polling egghead polling. It's very detailed policy-oriented polling. I was never tied into like the organization type politics. I was always tied into the communications issues and policy side. So this for me was, you know, nirvana.
Because you found him to be genuinely interested in policy and steeped in it, which seemed apparent.
Super interested, right? Yeah. Super interested. I mean, in the whole balanced budget thing, he was just trying to come up with different ways to balance the budget, protect Medicare, Medicaid, education, the environment. And by the way, that was some of the biggest stuff that we really did pull through and I think had some impact. But it's a serious, serious effort about the country. And then I always tell people, I will never make a judgment about the personality or personal character of political candidates without really knowing them. That you just don't know what they're really like. And even as I would find the most inauthentic moments will be seen by the press as authentic. and the most authentic moments will be seen as inauthentic. So people are very poor judges. And I do think in general, most of the people in public service are more dedicated and more honest and more serious than I think they get credit for.
You obviously work with the First Lady a lot, and people would say that she's inauthentic. Many people would, but I always felt like she just had a certain personality. What was your...
Well, I won't say she was authentic every second or inauthentic every second, but yeah. I would say that people's judgment of those moments when she was most authentic would tend to be wrong.
Yeah.
Right?
And why do you think that is?
Because what people really mean by authenticity is ringing their own bells, saying what they believe in. They don't really mean that they want to hear what the person actually believes
in. Or maybe it overlaps a little bit with oversharing. Like people are judged authentic when you see a lot of them, right? Like some of the the Twitter politicians of today or whatever.
Look, I always viewed that as overblown. There was all this stuff about likability and not. And I said, well, look, people elect leaders not because they're human, but because they're superhuman. And while I think George Bush did an amazing, probably did an amazing thing at humanizing himself, I also think he didn't get the respect for being the kind of strong leader that Clinton got. And I think that Hillary would have gotten had she won in 2008.
You worked with her in the 2000 campaign for Senate, right?
Yes.
And how was that?
2000 Senate race was like a presidential race. Never been in a Senate race with so much national coverage. And this continually spinning down of Hillary. I mean, the Republicans and the press seemed to just want to get her out of the race because it was kind of the things that they knew that if she got to the end, she could win. And then, you know, we were coming off of impeachment. There was a lot of suspicion about what did Hillary really think about what Bill Clinton did? Why didn't she ever talk about it? Again, my philosophy was to not wade into any of that. She instead had, I think, a remarkable connection with working class women, whereas actually at that time, professional women were very hesitant to support Hillary. And so I said, well, let's just go upstate. Let's do the upstate strategy where you could really appeal to working women, where you could really talk about how no child should leave their hometown to find a good job, right? And how the information age is depopulating and destroying rural family life. And she did fantastically well there for a Democrat. And only at the end did grudgingly professional women come along and jump on the bandwagon. The exact opposite of what would later be kind of her profile in 2016.
What was happening with you between her 2000 race and her presidential race starting in beginning of 07?
We stayed close because I would go over maybe once a month or 2 months over to the Senate office. And I looked, she was a workhorse. She was an amazing senator. At the end of the period when we went to catalog all the stuff that was done, there were so many boxes of things that she had done that like they gave up after a while. And then I was out there probably during that period doing a lot of the Microsoft. I was building up a kind of a DC office here. Originally I was here starting in 96 and through 2000. I never really got out of the White House or to breathe until the end of the administration. Even on the very last day of the administration, my wife and I left on January 19th. The president tried to reach me on the airplane, but they didn't put him through because he wanted to ask about whether he should sign the Mark Rich pardons, which I would have said no. But by the time I landed in L.A., he had signed them. So I never had a free moment. And so after that, I had some, that jumped right into the coming out of then that campaign. But now I had some free moments. We built up kind of an office here in D.C. There was no question that at some point Hillary was going to run for president. I worked on the Lieberman campaign that I was hopeful for. But, you know, when actually what happened was General Wes Clark got in and split the vote, which is why people have to be very careful about in this upcoming primary, who's going to split whose vote.
Your business was growing and I guess getting bought. And
so November 15th, 2001, we sell it to WPP. And that was a 4.5 year earnout. So it didn't finish till 2005, 2006 range. And at that point, it had gone so well. We pretty much doubled the business in size during that period. And then they asked me to take on Burson Marsteller as well. So I actually had not done PR per se before. I really did messaging and strategy and advertisements. But they asked me to do this. And I wanted the experience of kind of running, you know, a larger set of assets. As I said, I ran a small business because I had one.
What's your philosophy of management when you're running an enterprise?
I never like to set goals because goals are limiting. So I like to see, you know, what people can do. I think it's evolved from the various experiences, but I think when you run something, the first thing you need is a clear strategy. And that if you can't figure out a clear strategy in 60 to 90 days, you're never going to be able to do the job. It will overwhelm you. And then you've got to implement the strategy. And whether that strategy is, you know, to be more digital or to, in the case of Burson Marsteller, to kind of you know, bring in more senior and seasoned folks. I had the counterintuitive notion that if we had better, more expensive people, we actually would do better, right? And we did turn around and triple the bottom line in about 3 years, rebuilding the firm with, I think, a higher quality and level, because the whole thing had been deteriorating and sinking for 5 years. So I think you got to have a strategy. You got to have it in 60 to 90 days. You got to have a great team. If you don't have a great team around you that can execute the strategy, then it's not going anywhere. And then you got to get going. And if you do those things and you keep monitoring your progress, you have an effective organization. And if you don't create growth, then you're not creating a future for people. But if you do create growth, then you open up so many new opportunities for people, promotions and raises, et cetera, that you're going to be successful and they're going to be successful.
WPP is a huge holding company which bought other political shops like Blue State Digital or that I'm aware of. What was it like being under an umbrella like that?
I only kind of got to learn more about the WPP umbrella as I took on Burson Marsteller. When we were just Penn and Schoen, we were pretty much on our own. I wouldn't say that there was much impact in being part of the network. I think being part of Burson Marsteller, I had 70 offices around the world. It was integrated more into WPP. And what I felt generally about the way WPP ran was excellent financial management. I learned a lot about financial management, CFOing the team, and I thought very poor people management, that it wasn't a place that promoted and grew talent. If anything, I think it was less interested in talent, more interested in homogeneity. And I always like to have a high level of talented folks. I mean, that's what makes going to work exciting. That's what gives other people futures. So that's where I thought they fell down. So I tried to learn what they do well. In my later job here, I always say, I take the things that I thought they did well and apply them, and I reject the things that I thought were really poor.
How did it get going for you with 2007, Hillary running for president?
The big race was 2000. Mark was Hillary's chief strategist in 2008, as though I dropped in from a helicopter somewhere. Not that this was the culmination of 13 years of work beginning in 1995. I don't think any consultant had gotten through three elections with the Clintons. If you go back, Carville and Crowd only got through one. Well, they got through two when they lost after. I mean, you know, it's a tough biz. You do this until you lose, right? And so I got through 96. And the 2000 race, no one thought she could win in 2000. And you know, I was being dished on for saying that she could win in 2000 up until the last day. I was dished on almost as a nutcase. In the New York Times did a profile, like, of course she's not winning, but Mark goes out there saying that she's gonna win.
A Democrat's gonna usually carry New York in a Senate race, right?
Oh, yes and no. I mean, you know, out in those years, Alphonse D'Amato was there. And so, you know, you remember you had George Pataki, Republican governor. You had a very solid upstate Republican vote.
And you start out with Giuliani.
Suburbs, and New York. You know. So, no, it was not a foregone conclusion by any event, but I must say that I've never faced so much skepticism. And then we went through 2006, which was a picture-perfect re-election. She had broad support across New York. She had a minor challenger, but she won overwhelmingly. And so I was the logical choice then, right, to be her chief strategist in 2008, because I had been working with her since 2000. And if you kind of look at obviously her early foray into politics, the 92 to 94 level about healthcare was a disaster. So this way of entering politics, a way of dealing with the issues, being more very substantive, I think, in nature, not trying to be the most likable person, but to be a strong leader who can get things done for people, was working for her.
You know, one of the things about politics seems to be that if you are a consultant and you win, you're a genius. If you're consultant and you lose, you're a moron, or something akin to that. Obviously didn't win in 2008, but how did you see that race?
I mean, first of all, everyone said Barack Obama was not running. Of course, then he was running. From the day that he got into the race, I saw him as the only really substantial threat, because he had the ability to raise money. He could generate media And he had a lot of the elite media on his side. And we'd kind of later learn, too, that he secretly had like Reid and Pelosi and, you know, the lot of leaders in the Senate, you know, really behind his campaign.
He had a lot of establishment support, as they might call it now.
He did. He had everything that you need to pretend
to be a real contender.
Right. To have an upset. And so almost the exclusive focus was that. But in the structure of the campaign, although I was chief strategist, there were a lot of power centers. I didn't actually hire my own team within the campaign. There was a lot of people that just didn't want to go after Barack Obama. What I learned, and part of in the interim, I had worked for Microsoft versus Linux, right? And a huge controversy internally about how you handle Linux. And when we handled Linux was a Get the Facts campaign where we brought out that free wasn't really free, but it worked so incredibly well that when you're dealing with a phenomenon that's rising, you have to deal with that phenomenon early, because once it's out of the box, it's almost unstoppable.
So are you saying that if you were going to stop Barack Obama, you had to get him before Iowa or something?
You really did. You really had to say, and everyone would say, well, they don't run.
And you had to be rougher on him than people were comfortable with.
Well, he had a couple of vulnerabilities, right? I mean, his position on the Iraq war wasn't as consistent as he was maintaining it. His position on lobbying wasn't as consistent. I mean, he was putting together a coalition of African-American voters and the progressive voters in a unique way. I think the Clintons were shocked that they got so few African-American votes, given how well-liked they were and how well Hillary would do once Barack Obama wasn't on the ballot with African-American voters. And I think that he outmaneuvered her with the progressives, and what we would have had to do was dent the notion that he was as progressive as he was maintaining, compared to Hillary, who was the original progressive. Hillary was the original, you know, let's have health care for all.
Where would you ultimately place her in politics? We talk about her being an original progressive. There's a notion of the Clintons being hard to locate, but maybe in the moderate end of the Democratic Party. Where would you place her?
That's a good question, because I was trying to think about that the other day, because there were certain things that she was, you know, very strong about in terms of healthcare system, healthcare insurance, how it worked. And when she saw something like that, I think she would be a really strong fighter. On the other hand, if you go back to where she was on illegal immigration, she felt that no one should be able to jump the line and that it was very important to control the borders. She was very much against Iran and its growing influence in the world. But on the other hand, I think on economics, she would have had a kind of a really balanced view. I think she would have been a good president, balancing kind of what was happening with that time at the banks, having overreached and created a collapse. I think she would have been a strong, good leader, because she wouldn't have hesitated, I think, to act strongly or be bounded by one philosophy or another.
Where would you place yourself in the political spectrum?
Well, you know, I'm a moderate through and through, but you'd say I'm a classic, quote, liberal on social issues and conservative on economic issues. I mean, my biggest thing going back to 1985 was that I didn't think that class warfare was the right positioning for the Democratic Party. And one of the things that I did pretty extensively with President Clinton was to show, well, you know, if you say the Republicans want to cut Medicare to give tax breaks to the wealthy, that's a utilitarian argument. If you say the Republicans want to cut Medicare because they don't believe in it, that's a moral argument. That's actually more powerful. And you know what? All those rich people that you attack in the first one, they agree with you on the second one. I try to get it more about values and less about class warfare. And I think the return to class warfare is a mistake.
People who find fault in the way the 2007 campaign was run often talk about resource allocation between primaries and caucuses and how many delegates Obama picked up in small states that he won compared to big states that she won. What were you thinking about that as that was all sorting out with resources?
Well, I don't want to years later say, oh, Penn denied. The truth is the allocation of resources related to television and mail versus the caucus states was something that Harold Ickes and the manager, right, Patty Sleestwell, really took as their decision. In retrospect, they would agree, I would assume, that not enough resources were put into the caucus states, and that in fact the election was lost, not in the primary states or by the message war, because there was all this talk about she didn't have a message, etc. But the truth is she won the message war, and we won decisively, even with the 3 a.m. ad, and we won message-based primaries up until the last day. I've never seen anything like it. But the strategic miscalculation of not playing in the caucuses because of the system enabled him to pick up far more delegates in a place like Kansas than we could get in a big state.
And it's hard to tell if she had spent a ton in Idaho and those states that she didn't do as well in against him, if it would have made a difference, right?
Well, you know, Mike Henry was supposed to build an organization between Mike Henry, Patty Sleestwell, and Harold Ickes. That was their part of the campaign. Now, if I take another step backward to what I said before, had we successfully neutralized his progressive credentials and really gone through Hillary's really strong stance against political corruption, against lobbying, against the pharmaceutical companies, and that their stance on the Iraq War was not as dramatically different. Yes, she voted for it, but he wasn't there to vote for it. He voted for all of the funding once he was there. Had we neutralized him with the progressives, remember, just a percent or two back on the progressive vote would have turned the election back to Hillary. It was that close.
We talked about this notion of neutralizing someone early if they're a phenomenon. Do you think that would have been the similar advice would have been useful for her in 2016 with Sanders in the primary?
Well, I think that's generally useful advice.
Yeah.
I'm not sure in 2016 it would have been as easy to neutralize Sanders as I believe it would have been in 2008. You know, half the time people just didn't want to go after Barack Obama because our campaign was in D.C. And a lot of the people figuring, hey, if Hillary doesn't win, I'll wind up in the Barack administration.
But I also felt like they were very gentle to Sanders in the 2016 primary.
Well, I think if you look at it and you look at some of the debates, she tried to apply a little bit of that lesson. I don't think they
a little bit on guns and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they went after him. I mean, Sanders was livid about what he saw as just an attack campaign, which it really wasn't. It was sort of a half-hearted attack, and certainly nothing as effective as the 3 a.m.
And probably it didn't seem like she needed to, like she was going to carry the way.
Well, I think that was a large part of it. But when you look at it, that race continued to tighten up until the last day. By the end, he had 45% of the Democratic primary voters in his court. So you'd say he ran a successful campaign. She won. She didn't have to divert too much of her resources. He couldn't put together the same coalition that Barack Obama did. He was ultimately limited to younger voters and progressive voters. And she solidly held the African-American base that we didn't have against Barack Obama.
What was your view on Trump as he announced and moved forward through the primaries in 2016?
You know, first of all, I disclosed in fairness that like 20 years ago, although I wasn't part of it, my partner did we used to have a freelance billionaire wants to run for president poll, and we had done one for Trump, and
he commissioned one from you? Is
that what you're saying? He commissioned one. Really, Doug, I wasn't part of the poll other than I think I glanced at the results, or I wasn't part of the meetings. I did Ross Perot's benchmark actually back in the day. So we used to do this poll, and if we were doing Schultz today, you'd come back typically no chance. And I think that poll came back no chance. The one I did with Ross Perot came back. He had a chance. He just was not particularly stable. I don't know. I just kind of looked at this thing 20 years later, and I think that was wow, this guy's a kook. This is not going anywhere. He's riling things up, but he's never, ever getting above 30%. And then I said, well, he's never getting above 40%. He's definitely not getting above 50%. So I would view it with an extreme lens of skepticism.
And so you were continually surprised by how well he did, is what you're saying.
Shocked. I was shocked at how well he was doing.
Yeah.
He was verbally assaulting his opponents, elites with a deep history in the party like Jeb Bush were just being, you know, cast aside like banana skins. I've never seen anything like it.
Did you think that he had the wherewithal to beat Hillary in the general?
After he defeated 17 candidates, my attitude changed. My attitude is you better have respect for someone who has done the impossible. And then you really have to understand whether it was building Trump Tower, whether it was having the number one TV show, or whether it was winning the Republican primary in the first time that he'd ever been in politics, right? You better have more respect for an opponent, you know, that can do that. It's interestingly, at that point, people seem to heap incredible derision on him as though it was unthinkable and impossible, etc., when he had just shown you that it was now possible. And I, who thought he was a kook, had to say, well, you know, there's something here. There's obviously something here.
Yeah, I mean, I spent the fall quite concerned that he would win. And then I was certain it would be close, and I wasn't sure how it would bounce at the end. He made some strategic moves to change where his party was substantively that probably connected it better with the electorate on immigration and on trade. Do you think that that might have made the difference? How do you figure that out when you're looking at the results compared to personality stuff and so on?
I think personality got driven to a draw. 65% didn't like Hillary and 65% didn't like him. Never seen anything like it. Means the voters who were going to deciding didn't like either candidate. Therefore, and this was, I think, misjudgment in Hillary's campaign, therefore they were not going to vote on disliking Trump more. They didn't like him. They were going to vote on something else. And that something else tended to be the issues that he put out there. If you go back to 96, I said, well, look, let's take soccer moms, right, as our target. Let's reorient all our policies now to women in the workforce who, A, need provisions for their kids, and B, need to be empowered at work. And so that changes policy. It changes the target. And then if you go back to Hillary in 2000, let's be about the working class. Remember, what Trump did was he redefined politics now by taking trade and immigration, flipping it on its head. They were previously Democratic issues, you know, that secured the working class Democratic votes. And he took those two issues with no opposition, because now the kind of elite campaign that Hillary was running didn't care about those issues. In fact, had flipped on them. But the working class voters who had been struggling the most since 2009 really felt that they were heard through his candidacy. And that was the core of the reason they voted for him. Not because they liked his style or personality. In fact, they disliked it.
You worked for Berlusconi, right?
I did do some work for Berlusconi.
What lessons do you see from populism abroad? Or what parallels do you see sort of with the rise of Trump? And what do you take from that as a Democrat if you're advising people nowadays?
See, I don't think that populism really is the strongest factor, because in populism, there's this tremendous attraction to the leader. There's less attraction to the leader here and more attraction to the issues that he uniquely presented, some of which were core Republican, like cutting taxes, and some of which were core Democrat, like dealing with immigration and trade. I mean, there's no Republican congressman prepared to vote against trade agreements, right? This was a turning upside down of the issue. So what happened here was that's really powerful is, in the modern age, have these issues that were traditionally associated with the working class progressive movement, like immigration, like trade, did they get dissociated in a way that Trump picked up and put in his pocket? And will those issues come back? Will that be turned on his head? And if anything, Trump is a exceedingly divisive figure. If someone who wasn't so divisive took the same positions, how powerful would they be in terms of turning a working class that almost was taken for granted by the Democratic establishment?
With that in mind, what's the profile of a candidate that you think beats him in 2020, if one can, for the Democrats?
Well, I think if Biden is in good physical, mental, and generally good health. He is the ideal anti-Trump. Trump is all business. Biden's all government. Trump is all passion. Biden's kind of got his own sense of humor and ability on the stump that's really quite reassuring. When it comes to the core group here that's being fought over, the Rust Belt working class, Biden makes a very, very credible appeal to that in a way that a Bernie Sanders or an Elizabeth Warren would seem completely out of touch.
Why do you think they seem completely out of touch? They seem to have messages pretty pointed at working class. Well, depending on which subset of the working class, I guess. I mean, it seems like Sanders ran pretty well with independents, is kind of aligned with Trump on trade and in some ways.
Well, his appeal coming down from kind of Northeast elite, right? If you kind of look at it that culturally, these working class voters don't really associate well with kind of the Northeastern elites who they see as coming in but not part of their culture or their community. And I think it's a big jump. Those are so they can say, hey, I'm for the working class, but much of their stuff won't tie into kind of the cultural patriotism, like a family and religion that Trump successfully I think tapped into, and that somebody like Biden just has so much more accessibility to.
I want to talk for a second about the book that you wrote, or it's the new version of the book that you wrote.
Sure.
Microtrends. It's here on the desk in your office. What is the thesis of that book?
Well, the thesis of the book is that 10 years later, when you look at society, this world of change in technology that I thought would be amazing is amazing, but has a bunch of problems. And that if we don't start to correct some of those problems, things will spin seriously out of control. Namely, that in fact, the world of choice has led to people cocooning themselves. We've made choices so pleasurable that, hey, if you're news, you just watch Fox every day or MSNBC every day and you close yourself off. And AI, it has, you know, basically frightening prospects to take over an incredible amount of things in society without our kind of knowledge or understanding, that we really haven't focused on how the tech industry has evolved and its power, and that we haven't kind of dealt with the trends and counter trends, right? That really, if you think of America as a group of old economy voters and Silicon Valley voters, those two groups are vying for power. And the old economy voters reasserted themselves and took back, right, the government and to a large extent some of the economy for themselves after being hugely neglected. Hillary inadvertently explained the election the best when she said, well, the voters who voted for me, the half of the country voted for me, they actually were the innovative ones. They were living on 2/3 of the GDP, right? Well, that meant the other half that voted for him was living on 1/3 of the GDP. That was the problem.
It's kind of a flip to see, aside from maybe racially, to have the less well-off, the less prosperous, the more pressed be voting Republican, and then have a Republican president come in and bend the tax code further against them and such things.
Well, I don't know that Trump was ever a real Republican. I mean, I think the Republican Party, and I predicted in Microtrends 1, was likely to come apart at the seams, right? And I think ultimately either the voters were going to get new leaders or the leaders were going to have to get new voters, because there was a huge disconnect between people like Ryan and the voters who were Republican. And I think the voters got new leaders.
What worries you most about the Democratic Party as it's currently constituted and where it is taking itself?
Well, what worries me most about the Democratic Party is what's splashed on the news every day. The only leadership here seems to be coming from a progressive left, with things like the New Green Deal that, if you read it, are just proposals that will give Republicans a field day. Everything from destroying a $136 billion economy with 10 million jobs at stake to a guaranteed income for people even unwilling to work is an incredible policy prescription in a time of great economic prosperity. And at a time of, you know, in which the world is more sophisticated and difficult, where they're crying out not for another Trump, but they're crying out for another Clinton or Obama or someone who understands the full complexity, right, of the world today. So it's extremely worrying that the push to the left may basically sink the Democratic Party. This could be a repeat of 1972 of Nixon versus George McGovern, if we don't get on course. And
yeah, I mean,
pretty it's good. You know, we got 2 years.
Do you think the country is genuinely interested in large change or in gradual change?
Well, the country was interested in disrupting Washington. You have to understand that if you ask people how they're doing economically, about 70% will say that the economy is strong, and you'll have about 20% really dissatisfied with the economy and their economic circumstances. That's a lot lower than in the past. But if you ask people about the government, and you focus on the president's has a negative rating, the Democrats have a negative rating, the Republicans have a negative rating, and Congress has an unbelievably negative rating. So they want these institutions and folks to get together and do something other than fight with each other. And that is creating the biggest strain, stress, and pressure on America. So you look at what they really want versus what's coming at them now, I think the disconnect is enormous.
If you were advising Biden or another candidate of the general political stripe that you'd like to see as the next president, how would you counsel that person to position themselves?
When you go back even from Ed Koch to, you know, my work with Hillary and the Clintons, I was always about occupying more of the center. So if I were counseling, I'd have to admit my bias that I believe it's a more centrist country.
And that's a general election posture. What about in a primary election where there is the energy that you mentioned
there
in
is
a different
a lot of,
spot?
There's
a lot of voters across quite a wide spectrum.
Well,
Democrats,
and they're, right? That's right. And most voters, right, are still, they'll be liberal, but they won't be genuinely left, and they'll want to win. So frankly, I think that right now you could become off as the electable, responsible Democrat, right, who's ready to take on Trump, who's got the right, you know, experience to run a real government, and that this is not the time to like throw spaghetti against the wall, to have radical new proposals by
people
without
experience. Or give the
other
side something to really run against.
Right, or give the other side a real chance of winning. And that's real. We know that it's real because he did win decisively in the Electoral College.
Yeah. You've written a series of columns for The Hill, which have probably placed you at odds with the bulk of Reflex on our side. And a lot of them are about the investigation of Trump and the ongoing Mueller and other investigations. What's going on there? What are you thinking?
Well, I spent an entire year working with Clinton, seeing what an independent counsel investigation did. I saw how catatonic the president would be at some times under investigation. I saw the impact on the presidency. I saw how these things, you know, spiral out of control, how they change policy. Me and now another general reports the same thing, so I can say it. We're called before missiles were fired at Osama bin Laden to check if it would be seen as wag the dog. That shouldn't have happened, but for an investigation related to Monica Lewinsky. People don't understand the kind of impact this has. And I just feel that was wrong then. I spent a year of my life working against that. And I think it was wrong now to try to put the president, his family, the administration under the pressure of these investigations. It changes the presidency. It changes the nature, you know, of our elections. We have plenty of elections every 2 years, right? You can change. You can start by changing the House. You can change things. This is not productive for our democracy or country. It tends to spin it down. I must say, I got interested in writing the articles when I thought what the Republicans uncovered relative to the FBI was real. That what happened here with this dossier and the way that it got spread without any underlying facts or information or investigation of it, to then almost become a political hysteria inside these departments to create these investigations, is shocking and does really need to be exposed. And every Democrat, if it weren't a question of partisanship, would agree.
certainly the conventional wisdom among activist Democrats right now is that we have a president who has been corrupt in his business practices for a long time, who cheated in the election by collaborating with an enemy, who also is using the power of the office to enrich himself and is flouting rules. Isn't that the sort of person who should be investigated in a situation like that? Or why not? He's given so many causes, it seems like, for someone to actually look into how he does business.
Well, first of all, I think my general point is we use elections to get people in, get people out. Now, these elections today are well-funded. Hillary had another $500 million. More than he did. Yeah. She could do all the research. She could get out all the messages, get out all the commissions. We don't use our organs of government as investigative bodies against our political opponents. If we do that, then we might as well be in another country. It will dissemble our democracy. When you look at this, you look at someone here who became a billionaire, who had maybe he started as a with obviously
with multi-millions, help, yeah.
Right? But he, yeah. But you know, like ideas like the tower were big ideas that he did. He went on TV and had one of the top rated shows, and he defeated 17 candidates. As far as I know, no one has claimed that he defeated those 17 with Russian help. He won the thing, and he won the thing for valid reasons. The people in the center of the country felt disenfranchised by elite Democrats. Get real. And so the answer for them is not to spend all of this news time on, quote, trying to investigate, trying to find the business deal, trying to make being president impossible for anyone, because what goes around comes around. And you see the complete dissembling of Virginia now because of that. Oh, my God, what are we going to do? We went after Kavanaugh this way, but now we didn't go. We need civility back in politics. Elections are great. We have plenty of them. Okay, and we have the greatest elections in the world. Now let's let that be the primary mechanism, an outlet for, you know, whether or not people continue to govern or not, unless there's a real evidence of a current crime that is provable, that is real, that is genuine, right? When Spiro Agnew was taking bribes, that was a real crime in real time, and he went the next day.
If you find out that a governor dressed like a Klansman or in blackface or something 35 years ago, you think you should just leave that aside?
Well, look, every Democratic politician has said, I don't know anything about that, so you're not going to get me. So I'm not going to comment on that other than to say what I said, which is, okay, this has all now become a war not about issues itself, right? And the more we divert from issues itself to charges about people and their personality and their character. As I've said, if there's one thing you don't really know about any political figure you don't really know, it's what their real character is, unless you're upfront, close, and personal.
I'm sure that's true. Tell me a little bit about Stagwell, the company I'm sitting in right now. What are you doing with that? And that would probably be our last thing that I put you through here. First, what's the name mean?
Well, Stagwell's really just taken from a road that I have a little place out in the Eastern Shore. And I had taken that name, I don't know, a number of years ago when I was looking for like a male. And I discovered, well, wow, this is kind of an interesting name. So it doesn't have any real significance other than that. But look, the idea was to take my experience in technology, because after WP, I went for 3 years as chief strategy officer of Microsoft and head of advertising there, where I did both the Scroogled campaign and the Super Bowl ad with the football player with ALS, if you may remember that, explaining what technology meant to him. And even when I went to Microsoft, I had this idea that I could do what WPP was doing, but for the digital age, that they started in the age of disco, I could really start in the age of Taylor Swift. I could take advantage of kind of the new digital marketing. And after Steve exited Microsoft, he said, you know, I like that idea. And Ballmer agreed to be my chief funder. And we started to build up, you know, really at this point, close to 20 different companies, primarily in the digital marketing area. And now we're creating some exciting products. So I'm trying to take what I learned through the years about technology, about marketing, about building an organization, you know, about people, about running things, and apply it all together into something. And we've come, we're now about 2,000 people. I'm really proud of, you know, the team and what we've accomplished in the last 3 years.
Where would you like to take it? What would you like it to be as you keep moving forward?
Well, we may go as far as public. I mean, I think that we just spent all day yesterday actually planning our future, and we're about halfway through the journey that we had planned out. And I think the next part of the journey really scales us up even further. There's just, you know, there's almost no one who put together a kind of a modern marketing team based on kind of the combination of research and placing and creation of digital ad campaigns as we have.
Well, it sounds like a pretty interesting challenge. Interested to see how it pans out for you.
Yeah, thank you. And I combine it with, you know, my monthly Harvard-Harris poll and my teaching. So I may not be as directly involved as I was in politics and public opinion, but I enjoy keeping myself close to the pulse and being able to both be, you know, part of the evolving digital marketing ecosphere, and with the teaching that I do to students and with the poll, staying close to what I think public opinion really is and how complex the American psyche really is, particularly in the age of Trump.
Is there a question I should have asked that I failed to?
No, you were pretty complete.
Okay. Anything else you want to say?
No, that was good.
Thanks, Mark. It was a great pleasure.
Thank you.
That was Mark Penn of the Stagwell Group. He's at stagwellgroup.com. Penn's observation that if you're going to beat a phenomenon, you have to discredit him or her early is still rattling around in my head. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.